It's here again, the season of giving. On the World Vision Report today, we celebrate people who give all year round. Like these seniors in Florida, stitching dolls for children in Darfur.
We send now 2,000 to Darfur. It keeps on because it's no more dolls for Darfur. It's doll for world peace. I call that a drop of peace. It's not very much, but many drops make a river. That pleases me.
And in Bethlehem, Jews and Palestinians team up to make organic t-shirts.
I mean, the fact that we've got common ground for Jews, Muslims, Christians, and atheists on Virgin Mary Street in Bethlehem, it's what most people of faith would consider a miracle.
Around the world with the World Vision Report, I'm Peggy Waymeyer. First, this news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. It's the season of giving, and we're not talking about gifts you unwrap. We're talking about that other kind of giving, giving of time, resources, and passion to try and improve the world just a little bit. So on this week's show, we're going to bring you a collection of our favorite stories about that kind of giving. We start in Florida, in a place aptly named Sunrise. Residents at the Spring Tree Assisted Living Facility came up with a project to improve the lives of children in Darfur. Judy Martin reports they improved their own lives in the process.
If Santa's workshop was relocated to an activity room at an assisted living home, and in place of elves were 24 elderly women, it might look like this. At one table, a woman traces simple gingerbread figures onto fabric. Another draws a smiley face onto the material. At another table, a woman carefully cuts out the doll patterns from the material. And at a third table, that's where you'll find Trist Cardoza, a woman in her 80s who's intently sewing the pieces together. She's a strong thread in the fabric of seniors sewing to make a difference.
I think it's great.
So you get excited about it?
Yeah. Tired at the end of the day, but I like it. I don't mind it. I'm doing it for a good cause, so I don't care.
The women here at the Spring Tree Assisted Living Facility make these toys for a project called Dolls for World Peace. Hundreds of cotton-filled dolls are piled in the room's center, waiting to be packed and shipped to children in refugee camps in Darfur and poor children in other parts of Africa and South America.
I just think of the face of the little kids receiving those dolls, and that all worth it.
That's Denise Duda, the founder of Dolls for World Peace. The 72-year-old also lives at the assisted living home. She says she got the idea to make the dolls while watching a news report about children in the refugee camps in Darfur. When she saw those images, thoughts of another time flooded her mind. In the 1960s, she was a nurse in the mountains of Bolivia. She remembered how the children there lived in poverty, but they still had families. Not so for many of the children in Darfur.
The baby in Darfur, their parents have been killed. They were orphans. They need food, clothing, medicine, all things that I cannot anymore provide. And I'm limited physically. I was close to tears when I saw those little babies in the crib.
Babies, she thought, who needed a doll to hold to ease their pain. So she went to Linda Forrest for help to get the project off the ground. She's the recreational activities director at Springtree.
I said, Denise, how many dolls do you want to make? She said, 1,000. I said, ha, you're crazy. You're absolutely crazy. She said, I said, 1,000. I said, okay. She said, now make it happen. And I did.
No money or supplies, but they had a mission, which filtered out into the community. And as if Santa had a hand in it, just about overnight, sewing machines were donated. Bolts of fabric were showing up, and the activity room was overflowing with cotton stuffing. Before you knew it, they had 1,000 dolls.
That was like a miracle happening. We were expecting a miracle because everything has been miracle in that project. But for me personally, I have reason to exist.
This project fills a void for Denise Duda. She became depressed after being severely injured in a car accident 3 years ago. But Dolls for World Peace changed that. Linda Forrest, who has become the executive director of the charity, says the more than 24 women who volunteer with this project have also been transformed.
They don't talk about their illnesses anymore. They talk about, do you have more work? Do you have more work? Go buy material, go buy material. Music plays all the time. They sing, they dance. And Antoinette, who has Parkinson's really bad, and Rose, who has Parkinson's really bad, their hands shake really badly, tremors. But they just sat at the machine and so, for some crazy miracle, they didn't shake.
Forrest says some of the women who live with Alzheimer's and diabetes have also experienced progress. For example, Adele Levine admits she can be a little forgetful sometimes, but doesn't mind an occasional prompt from Linda.
Where are the dolls going?
To somewhere. I see. Oh, they're gone. I had a stroke. Mm-hmm. I can do things, but I forget. But I don't care. I still do what I have to do. And that's it.
And these are going to kids in Darfur and Colombia?
Oh, they're going all over the world. And it's nice. It's just a nice thing to do. I like it.
Since November of last year, the seniors, along with some help from occasional volunteers, have made an incredible 12,000 dolls. Other nonprofit groups take the dolls overseas when they go on their own trips. The delivery service, DHL, also lent a hand, sending 2,000 dolls to Darfur free of charge. For Denise Duda, those first dolls made for the children in Darfur were just the beginning.
We send now 2,000 to Darfur. It keeps on because it's no more dolls for Darfur. It's dolls for world peace. I call that a drop of peace. It's not very much, but many drops make a river. That pleases me.
The dolls have traveled even farther than Duda ever imagined. They've been included in care packages that military moms sent to their children serving in Iraq. Those soldiers hand out the dolls to Iraqi children. In Sunrise, Florida, I'm Judy Martin for the World Vision Report.
Probably heard about the Giving Pledge. That's the one where earlier this year, Warren Buffett and Bill Gates teamed up to ask other billionaires and millionaires to give 50% of their net worth to charity. So far, 40 people have signed on. For many of them, this is a new endeavor. Frank Butler has been giving away large amounts of money for years. Frank and his wife, Ruth, live in a modest home in Topsfield, Massachusetts. He started out as an engineer for the Eastman Corporation, and he worked his way all the way up to president. He's earned a lot of money over the years, but he's also given a lot of it away. Frank doesn't like to talk numbers, and he and his wife prefer to give anonymously, but he estimates that he and his wife have given away about $2 million so far. Here's his story in his own words.
When I proposed to Ruth, I said, honey, we'll never have much money, but we'll have lots of fun. And God's got a sense of humor or something, but I never expected to wind up being president of a corporation. And so more money poured into our lives, and we just felt it would be the right thing to do would be to share it. I was raised in a Christian home. My mother was very devout. She raised me to have daily devotions and to tithe. My father was an electrical engineer, and he was certainly a fiscal conservative. He taught me, give away the first 10% of everything that you earn, save the second 10%, and then live on the balance. As far as I'm concerned, the basic themes of the scriptures come from what we would call the Old Testament, but Micah 6:8, what does the Lord require of thee but to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God? With a sense that that we have to care for one another. We are one world, and we're all part of the same family as far as I'm concerned. Well, is it fair that I, who was born into an American middle-class home, college education, white male, I mean, all those things right away give me tremendous privilege. And whether you call it noblesse oblige, whatever you want to call it, I felt deeply a sense of responsibility for those who had less. I also heard about, I never met him, but heard about an industrialist named R.G. Letourneau, who had a big earth-moving business out in Texas. And he, as a prosperous man, gave away 90% and lived on 10%. What some of my friends have called the inverse tithe. But I thought, wow, that's the way to go. I mean, if you can do it. And Ruth and I talked about that would be a worthy goal. We thought that we would try to move toward that level, see if we could do it. We moved to 60 to 70% of our income being given away. And it's because my wife's an incredible manager, and we live relatively inexpensively. I know that we are urged to give sacrificially, but I never looked at it that way. I don't figure I've sacrificed a thing, because the intangibles, I mean, the intangibles from that, sure, I didn't have a big motorboat or, you know, and a fancy second home and or third home and all this other stuff. I never wanted those things. I'm doing what I want to do. If I had any regrets, it wasn't what I gave away, it's that I didn't give away more. When we started the North Shore Shelter here, it was at Crombie Street, and I'd been to Haiti, worked with Mother Teresa and all these, and yet I remember that first night Ruth and I were there, and about, I don't know, 10:30 at night, it was in February, and it was just above freezing, cold, blustery night, and we got a call from, I don't know whether it was the Saugus police or who, and they had picked up a guy in a wheelchair, and he was at 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, was wheeling up Route 1A, trying to get to our shelter, and they wondered if we had room and if they could bring him in. And for some reason, that touched me more than any of the things I'd seen elsewhere in the world. There's tremendous need all over this world, and I'm sitting here in this lovely home, and I've never gone hungry. You know, the saying is, if you have a pair of shoes or something to put on your feet, a second pair of pants, and know where your next meal is coming from, you're wealthy.
That was Frank Butler. He's a member of the 50% League, an organization in which people pledge to give away more than half their money. For more information about the 50% League, go to our website, worldvisionreport.org. Coming up on the World Vision Report, doing business in Bethlehem. Stay with us. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. The label says Made in Bethlehem. It's not a nativity scene or a Christmas ornament, but a T-shirt. The shirt is the result of collaboration between a business in Bethlehem and one in Boston. Here's Rebecca Shear with the story.
In 2001, Adam Neiman founded No Sweat Apparel, a Boston-based company that sells clothing and footwear made in union factories in the U.S. and developing nations, like Indonesia, South Africa, Argentina, and most recently, Palestine.
So then we've got this one here. This is our women's tee.
Let's see this label. 100% union made, 100% sweatshop free, 100% organic, union made in Bethlehem, West Bank. The Made in Bethlehem T-shirts in No Sweat Stockroom come blank or printed with various designs. One of them features a proverb from Japan.
What does it say?
Vision without action is a daydream. Action without vision is a nightmare. And boy, are we living that today, huh?
Neiman's referring to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And when he says we, he means it. Neiman is an American Jew,
and has been watching the situation closely for years. He believes that one of the ways to end the struggle is by improving the Palestinian economy.
Because young men with guns and without jobs is a recipe for violence. And while economic development isn't a substitute for a diplomatic solution, no diplomatic solution can be sustained without a sustainable Palestinian economy.
In recent years, the once thriving Palestinian textile business has grown stagnant. So when Neiman learned about this factory on Virgin Mary Street in Bethlehem, where the workers belonged to a trade union,
as soon as I heard, oh, good factory, West Bank, Bethlehem, I was like, I gotta go.
So he did. At a falafel joint in Brookline, not too far from No Sweat's headquarters, Neiman tells the story. It was July 2006, and the war in Lebanon broke out while his plane was in the air. But he landed safely and was whisked past the checkpoints to Arja Textile Company, where he spent a week with the manager and staff.
When I got back, everyone asked me how I found the Palestinians. And I said, they're just like my family. They're loud, they're argumentative, they're passionate, they're stubborn. They look like my family. There was just one difference. They wouldn't let me pay for anything.
But they seemed uncertain, he says, about getting involved in the project.
Part of it is that everybody over there has had their hearts broken so many times that the idea of getting one's hopes up again for any kind of positive interaction between Jews and Arabs, it's hard for people to put their hearts out again.
Arja Textile's been around since the 1960s, primarily doing business with Israelis. So when Neiman proposed this idea of going organic and global,
I was surprised from his idea when I meet him first time in Bethlehem. It was a new idea that we never think about it.
Elias Alarja is Arja Textile's general manager. He's the one who unionized the company back in 2005. Today, his 150 employees receive above minimum wages, plus benefits such as paid holidays and health care. And thanks to the Made in Bethlehem collaboration, his company is receiving benefits too.
Since we started working with Adam, we are having a great work, and they add for our production more than 10% to our profit and our work here.
And that work is extensive, from knitting and dyeing to cutting and sewing, as well as other assorted tasks.
Right now I'm making samples for colors.
This is Osama Arar, a chemical engineer at Arja Textile. He's using a glass wand to mix different shades of dye inside a beaker.
I worked in the last in Israel, but now 1.5 years I'm working here in Arja Textile. It's better for me. It's very nice here work in the territories because it's difficult now to work in Israel.
The Made in Bethlehem collaboration has had a few glitches, like the time the Israelis confiscated several shipments of fabric dye, thinking they contained materials for making bombs. But overall, the Israeli government applauds the project. In fact, Adam Neiman's received much praise as a result of the collaboration. He says the Made in Bethlehem shirts appeal to consumers who want to do something concrete to alleviate the strife plaguing the Middle East. Still, thus far, production costs have outrun sales, so No Sweat Apparel has yet to break even on the venture.
What we're doing, most folks consider slightly less risky than betting on peace in the Middle East. But I would say it's a lot less risky. I mean, the fact that we've got common ground for Jews, Muslims, Christians, and atheists on Virgin Mary Street in Bethlehem, it's what most people of faith would consider a miracle.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Rebecca Shear in Brookline, Massachusetts.
We're staying in Boston now, where the World Vision Report's Cynthia Graber caught up with a couple of young people who work to improve the lives of kids in developing countries. Sarah Nuss and Julia Haney are co-founders of a group called Kids to Kids. They raise money for small grants to help fund sports, arts, and education programs overseas. The grants are geared to help kids be kids. The girls were in first and third grade when they started this project. Both their parents had been working on medical missions in the Dominican Republic.
And they brought back pictures that really spoke to us. They were really powerful pictures. And we just decided we really wanted to help out. And the next year that they went back to do more medical work in the Dominican Republic, we collected supplies within our classroom and sent it down with them.
You were in first and third grade at the time. How did these pictures inspire you, as you say? What do you remember thinking?
I think that it's really, really easy for kids that are that young to have no idea what's going on. And I think that it was just kind of almost a shock to see these pictures and to hear these stories when we were that young about other kids that were our age that we assumed to be having the same kinds of things that we had every day, and they didn't.
So then when you got into middle school, this became something more formal. How did you turn this into the actual organization, Kids to Kids?
Well, as we got older, as Julia said, we realized what we were doing really wasn't as effective as we wanted it to be. And our parents helped us out and helped lead us in the direction of raising money, which was more effective than actually collecting supplies and sending it down to the developing countries. And we realized that we really wanted to make a bigger impact throughout the world, so we decided to partner with Peace Corps. And now we actually raise money through fundraisers and donors and Peace Corps volunteers and community leaders throughout the developing world in 10 countries actually apply for grants for up to $500 to us. And we review them twice a year and pick grants that really connect to our goal and are sustainable and really fun for the kids.
For example, actually, this past March, some kids from my school, we went down to the Dominican Republic to see a couple of the projects that we've supported in the past, one of which was a girls' softball team in one of the Batays, which are the sugarcane plantations in the Dominican Republic. It was really amazing. I mean, it's one thing to read about it on paper and to read stories about it afterwards and how it touched the kids, but it's a completely other thing to go down and actually see the community and talk to the people in the community about how the softball team affected their lives. And it was just a young girl softball team, and the entire community rallied around them, went to all of their games. They would march around the Batay when they won, and that was really amazing to see.
So what did they tell you about the team? What was that like?
I speak broken Spanish, and they spoke a little tiny bit of English, but there was the Peace Corps volunteer who was there, actually spoke both languages and could translate better for us. The girls, especially in the Dominican Republic, and I think in many developing countries, are kind of pushed to the back when it comes to sports, and they never really get to participate. And this was kind of their chance to really participate in a sport that they otherwise wouldn't have been able to do. And they all loved it so much. And it actually is really interesting because they started a whole softball league between the Batays, so there are multiple teams down there now.
How do you get the funding for these projects?
Throughout the world, we try to raise money through fundraisers, and we have donors donate to us. And online on our website, there's actually ways that toolkits actually that kind of help you think of fundraising ideas and how to do fundraising.
When you say help you raise funds, are these all kids who are running these fundraisers? Who does the fundraisers?
Yeah, it's kids. Like on the website, there's a way for teachers and parents to help get kids involved, but it's mostly kids that are running these fundraisers.
You guys are both clearly extremely passionate about this. How do you get other kids to be passionate about what's going on with kids in other countries?
First of all, telling the story, I think, is important because I gave a short talk at my school to a few people about public service this year. And before I did that, I was talking to a bunch of students at school. The vast majority of people think that you should start public service after you are older, after you've made a lot of money, and then you can donate it. And it's really not true because you can start public service from whatever age.
Another important thing that helps inspire kids to be passionate is, like, on our website, you can actually see success stories from the projects that we've funded. And those are really great because they come along with pictures. Sometimes kids even send us in postcards or artwork that they've drawn and thank you letters. And those are also really inspirational. And those are a really good tool for helping kids get inspired.
What are your plans for the organization for the future? What do you hope to see happen with it?
We actually really are hoping to expand to 5 new countries before the end of the year. That's one of our main goals for this year. And we also hope to get over 5,000 new members by 2011.
And the organization has grown a lot, especially very recently, because, I mean, we currently have reached over 30,000 kids in these countries, but that number is almost triple what it was a year ago.
Wow. Do you guys have time for your schoolwork?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we definitely have time.
I think it definitely takes up a lot of time, though. It's true. It should count as a class.
Yeah, I hear that kind of nervous laughter that, are my parents listening to this? Do they know how much time I'm spending on it?
I think they know.
Julia Haney and Sarah Nuss are two of the founders of Kids to Kids. Thanks so much for speaking with us today, and best of luck with your project.
Thank you so much.
It's great to talk to you.
You too.
You've probably seen the commercials.
Invite the world to come and start over. Jamaica, because on this blessed island, every day is a new beginning.
The long white beaches of Jamaica, the sun setting on an idyllic scene, and in the background, holiday resorts hosting appreciative tourists. But not all of Jamaica is quite so beautiful. Some of it has grinding poverty and crime. The resort company Sandals is trying to bring the two worlds together. Judith Ritter reports on a hotel with a heart from the village of White House, Jamaica.
A young woman in faded jeans and a tank top kneels down in a small field and hacks at the ground with a machete. She's breaking up clumped soil around fledgling leafy pepper plants.
I'm trying to get some dirt around the pepper.
Barbara Stewart and her business partner have only been farmers for 2.5 years. That's when the five-star kitchen at their local Sandals Resort needed fancy peppers. The hotel decided not to import them. Instead, it offered to give tools, seeds, and agricultural training to a few local people. It also guaranteed them a market for 33 pounds of peppers a week. Stewart jumped at the chance, and so did her partner, Melvin Jones, who used to work as an itinerant laborer.
Before I was self-employed, you had to be walking around begging for a desk job. You go out, you ask a man to give you a day's work or a week work. But no, there is no way you can fire yourself.
Freedom from the whims of bosses and the insecurity of casual labor aren't the only things Jones has gotten since he's become his own boss.
Since that, I have made an improvement. We have moved into a concrete structure with a deck top. That means that in case of a hurricane, you had nothing to worry about.
The Pepper Farm is just one of the community efforts run by Sandals White House Resort. It's company policy that each Sandals property adopt at least 2 community projects. But White House has gone above and beyond. The Human Resources Department helps run a school project that helps kids get dental checkups. The hotel is helping to save the island's disappearing indigenous music by hiring octogenarian musicians to play in one of its restaurants. And up in the mountains, 20 miles from the luxury resort, there's a mentoring project for abandoned boys at the Clifton Boys House. Today, Tashawn McCarthy, a Sandals landscaping supervisor, is playing basketball and just hanging out with the 32 boys. All on his boss's time.
They reach out to you a lot because some of them were grown up in broken homes, and it seems as if they didn't have much of a father figure. If they had a father figure, it seemed that it was an abusive home.
The 26-year-old McCarthy reaches up and touches his heart as he speaks about his boys.
Yes, you reach out to somebody and you actually see some improvement. It's a real joy deep within.
That joy Tashawn and other Sandals employees experience is one of the perks of their jobs. What starts off as an obligation, volunteers say, ends up as a privilege. The community service requirement began more than 2 decades ago in Kingston, Jamaica, when Sandals founder Butch Stewart started his very first hotel.
My old man believes in taking care of the people however he can. I mean, he loves this country.
Adam Stewart, at 27, is the heir to the Sandals empire, and he's the new CEO. Handsome and rich, he well might be the country's most eligible bachelor. But he's not out clubbing. He's following in his father's footsteps with service to local communities. And that's a tradition in this Jamaican family.
I must have been about 8 years old, and we were actually driving, my mom, my sister, and I, and my dad. There was a lady on the side of the road with a baby rocking back and forth and wailing. She had nothing. The car went silent. We turned around. He got out of the car. My mother went and hugged her, gave her some money, and we sat on the side of the road for like 15 minutes. That's one of those things that I think about constantly.
Back in the Rocky Hills, the sun is still high, and pepper farmers Melvin Jones and Barbara Stewart and a couple of neighbors are clearing the steep mountainside with machetes and shovels. Stewart's hands are cut and blistered. It's a tough job, but she's undaunted and almost seems honored by the chance to do this.
Some people think that cultivating stuff, right, is a degraded thing. You know, their hand cannot get messed up and stuff like that. But they are silly people. Because without foods or vegetables, fruits, you can't live, right?
Recently, Sandals put donation boxes in all their gift shops to encourage their guests to get involved in their charities. And Adam Stewart, the young philanthro-capitalist, believes a job training program that Sandals runs could be a model for other Jamaican businesses.
We bring people in, we pay them a stipend, we teach them the skill set, and we give them a certificate, and we guarantee them work, either with us or with another hotel. If every business in Jamaica took two people in, there'd be 100,000 kids off of the street. The greatest thing in the world you can do for somebody is give them a job.
And in response to possible criticism that all this is just cheap PR, the soft-spoken heir to the Sandals empire says, "We just want to do it because it's good business to do the right thing." For World Vision Report, I'm Judith Ritter in White House, Jamaica.
Stay tuned for more on the World Vision Report. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. People buy Christmas trees all over the world at this time of year. In Lagos, Nigeria, you won't find the trees for sale at tidy Christmas tree lots or in big nurseries. The way to buy trees in Lagos is from your car when you're stuck in traffic. That's where street vendors hawk them by the dozens. Richard Locke brings us this story for our street vendor series.
It's 4 p.m. in Lagos, but already the evening rush hour is well underway.
Christmas tree! Christmas tree! Christmas tree!
23-year-old Femi Folonso weaves in and out of the slow-moving traffic, trying to get the attention of drivers. He's laden with plastic Christmas trees, which he holds above his sweating head. Femi is among hundreds of thousands of young men who each day here take advantage of the city's gridlocked roads to hawk anything from mobile phone covers to puppies.
I'm selling Christmas tree. So as December don't come, I'm selling Christmas tree.
It's December, so I'm selling Christmas trees. I'll sell anything to make a small profit, just enough money so I can eat and don't need to steal.
Look at this. This one is Christmas tree.
Look at this one. We call it 4 feet because that's its length. I bought it in the market for 750 naira. Maybe I can sell it for 1,300 naira, maybe 1,500, maybe even 2,000.
Every day, Femi trawls up and down the crumbling six-lane highway that connects the commercial center island of Ikoyi with the mainland. It's a well-known bottleneck and prone to go slows. That's Lagos jargon for traffic jams.
We pray for a go slow. May God let there be a go slow so I will make money to eat. If there is no go slow, then I'm angry.
The vendors require little capital to set up, just enough money to buy something from the market to sell on. Their overhead is non-existent, so their goods are cheaper than those in shops. Nonetheless, each sale is an exercise in negotiation.
How much do you call it?
1,000 naira.
Ah, it's too expensive.
All right. How much last?
Femi's asking price for one of his Christmas trees is 3,000 naira. That's about $25. It's an absurd amount, and so the bargaining theatrics begin.
It's quality one.
Are you
it's
sure?
It's quality one and it's 4 feet.
He has to jog to keep up with his potential customer. 100 yards or so later, and a deal is struck. But that's not always how things turn out, especially if traffic is light.
Some people are just gonna call me.
Sometimes drivers call me over to see something, then steal my merchandise and drive off.
And how does that make you feel when they run away without paying?
There's nothing I can do. I will just say, please God, I will sell again.
On a nearby street, the traffic's a little more free-flowing. 22-year-old Jeff Okodilichiko takes a break on the sidewalk. He leans against a box of pirated DVDs, an eclectic collection of Hollywood and local blockbusters. Jeff comes from northern Nigeria. He arrived in Lagos 12 months ago, thinking he'd find a good job. But so far, he's been disappointed.
It's not easy for me to get office work now, and that's why I'm doing it.
So you're saying that if you don't know the right people, it is hard to get a job?
Yeah.
So he resorts to hawking ripped-off DVDs.
It's dangerous because at times you may...
It is always dangerous. At times you may be knocked down by a vehicle.
The street vendors don't have licenses and they don't pay taxes. So basically, their work is illegal. But for unemployed youths like Jeff who haven't finished their education, there are few other choices.
And if I don't do this, then I may decide to stay at my village.
If I don't do this, then I may decide to return to my village. But I won't have any money to support myself. And they say idleness is the devil's workshop. So it is better for me to hawk and find other things to do than stay idle.
Jeff's sentiment is a common refrain from these street vendors, resigned to their hand-to-mouth existence, but not defeated. For the World Vision Report, I'm Richard Locke in Lagos, Nigeria.
Shop owner Diane Stevens didn't expect to go to Africa, but when she saw photographs of women who had been brutally treated during Sierra Leone's civil war, she felt compelled to do something about it. Here's her story.
A woman from my church, she actually is a client of mine, and she came to the salon and told me about her work in Sierra Leone. She actually shared photos of a camp filled with amputees who were victim of a 10-year-long war. I heard about the plight of the women there, and she told me about a person that worked there, and she was a hairstylist, so of course that caught my attention. I had no plan on going to Africa. That was just not in my thought process. But every morning at 3 a.m., I would wake up and think about Sierra Leone. So I thought, okay, God is clearly trying to tell me something. So that's when I prayed and thought, maybe we can just do something where we can help them economically. I identified three women from my church, and then I rounded up three women from the salon, three women that were very, very excited about teaching a curriculum in cosmetology. Well, over in Sierra Leone, they put up flyers and said their Americans are going to come and a cosmetology program is going to happen. They had to turn women away because we didn't have a facility large enough to house more than 300 people. Well, when we walked into the facility, there were women outside because the facility could only hold about 150 women. It was such a small room and everybody was packed in like sardines. And the women, they were singing when we walked in the room. So, of course, we all started crying. It was just so overwhelming. I was just truly humbled. I just felt like I wanted to do everything that I could to impact the women there. We totally taught them as if it was a cosmetology school. So we started out with the basics, even just the regular shampoo. So we didn't have any water supply, so the women brought 50 buckets of water, put it on their heads, and brought it to the center. They wound up creating like a makeshift. They had a half of a hose that was cut open on both ends. So they put the hose in the bucket of water, and they siphoned it out with their mouth, and then they created like a little waterfall. So we were able to rinse our clients out. Then after that, we started showing them how to do finishing. They were amazed at the blow-dry techniques. I don't know if they've ever even seen a blow-dryer, but we realized there was no electricity. We had to rent a generator, but they had a big fan plugged in because there was, no air conditioning. So when we plugged in our supplies, our finishing tools, like our blow-dryers, it would cut the fan off. So now it's about 120 degrees in this place. So we're just dripping wet. It was just unbelievable. They would model their hair. These women were so talented. They're going to be practicing on each other and getting better and better. A lot of them said, well, Miss Diane, well, where will we get a job? When actually we found out they weren't even eating. And I said, well, there's a woman, when we were driving from our hotel to the center, we noticed bread stands, fruit stands. I said, well, maybe we should start with bartering. And if you would do that young lady's hair in a beautiful style, maybe you could feed your family for a week. They're feeding their families. They're exchanging for medical supplies. There's a nurse in town. The nurse now comes in one day a week. She comes into the center and gets her hair done. And so it is just amazing that the women are finding ways to survive. And that's a start. It gave them just a hope. And that's what we saw in their eyes. Although I love my clients and this is always wonderful, when you do work from your heart, you just never forget the importance and the meaning of that job. So I'll always be a giver backer. I'm going to always give back in some area because the reward is so big.
Diane Stevens spoke to us from her hair salon in Washington, D.C. TV cooking shows are really popular, and right now there are lots of programs about how to cook turkey or bake that perfect Christmas cookie. But for some people, learning basic kitchen skills is more important than learning how to ice a Christmas cake, especially for those in the kitchen of Fair Start Restaurant in Seattle. Cynthia Graber reports.
It's class time at Fair Start, a cooking school in downtown Seattle. A handful of students stand at various stations. One guy holds a carrot in one hand and his peeler in the other. He's about to be tested on his speed.
On your mark, get set, go. Move a little faster, Kelly.
Fair Start began back in 1987 when local chef David Lee started delivering meals to homeless shelters. But 5 years later, he had an epiphany. Lee is no longer head of the program, so Megan Karch, Fair Start's current director, picks up the story.
He realized that while it was very important to provide meals to people in need, perhaps it was even more important to provide a way out. And so that's how we were founded, was on bringing the folks that he was providing the meals to into the kitchen, teaching them a job skill, and then ultimately giving them the opportunity to change their life through job.
You got your carrots?
These homeless students aren't learning to be top chefs. That would take many years at a culinary school. But graduates can work as line or prep cooks on cruise ships, in assisted living kitchens, or in local restaurants. Until the recession hit, the program managed to help 80% of graduates find jobs within only a few months. Today, it's taking a little longer. In addition to 4 months of cooking classes, Fair Start helps students find a bed in a local shelter or a halfway house. They also receive health and job counseling. In exchange, they agree to stay clean and sober. After students learn the basics, they work with teachers on preparing food to bring to shelters and childcare centers around the city. Last year, Fair Start gave away 500,000 meals made and delivered by their students. Jeff, he doesn't want his last name used, is one of them.
It's kind of a fun thing, and it's kind of a neat thing, because they're helping us out, and we're helping somebody else out.
But there's one place here where students get the best kitchen training possible, in Fair Start's very own restaurant. Its expansive windows look onto a busy street corner in downtown Seattle. The dining room has exposed wood, lofty ceilings, and white tablecloths. Every day, people from neighboring businesses come in for a reasonably priced, top-quality lunch. Dinner's only served on Thursdays, when the restaurant offers a pre-fix meal planned by a guest chef and cooked by a few of the most advanced students. Tonight, the guest chef is Michael White from Seattle's Brasserie Margaux.
And then the entree is a roasted leg of lamb, young spring lamb, and it's going to be sliced. It's going to be on a bed of grilled squashes, zucchini and yellow squash, and also some red bell peppers. And then we're going to do a mold of wild rice pilaf.
Chef White brought his assistant from his own restaurant to help out, a line cook named Ken Kelly. Kelly's been working at Brasserie Margaux for a year. and he's a graduate of Fair Start.
If you don't like the end that's on that, cut it off.
Ken strides confidently around the kitchen, calling out directions. He was jobless and homeless after a brief stint in prison. He heard about Fair Start and decided to give it a try. He says the program gave him just what he needed, a fair start, and he loved it.
A lot of the techniques were new to me. You know, I'm a devout carnivore, so I had to learn how to cook vegetables. And I've actually found that I can cook vegetables that I like.
Ken got the job with Brasserie Margaux right after he graduated.
Employers like the one I went to work with would not have talked to me if it wasn't for Fair Start and the community support that it has. Nobody looked down on me. Nobody avoided me. And I've worked really hard to prove myself worth being there. I am a lot happier on the days when I have to go to work than the days when I don't.
As dinner draws to a close, Fair Start director Megan Karch stands on the stairway, mic in hand. Each week, the new graduates get to tell a bit of their stories. And tonight, two women are graduating, one of whom already has a job at a local restaurant. But first...
And we also, it is a very special night because one of our graduates is back with Brasserie Margaux teaching our students.
Ken Kelly stood here a year ago as a graduate. Now he beams from the stairs as he accepts the Fair Start hat and water bottle that the guest chefs receive. For the World Vision Report, I'm Cynthia Graber in Seattle.
Lots of kids, a visit to an amusement park is the best gift of all, but not every child has that kind of opportunity. It costs nearly $70 for one child to go to Disney World in Orlando, Florida. $70 admits 20 children to Fantasy Kingdom near Dhaka, Bangladesh. So when writer Kelsey Timmerman was there a while back, he had an idea.
Behind me are the gates of Fantasy Kingdom, the brightest, cleanest, and most out-of-place sight in all of Bangladesh. Two very happy cartoon kids stand atop the kingdom's plastic walls, looking out onto the crowded streets and nearby garment factories. I'm with my friend Ruma. She's taking the day off to help me with my crazy idea. Take as many kids as we can into the amusement park. Any Bangladeshi who can afford a $3 admission into Fantasy Kingdom is relatively rich and lives nowhere near this neighborhood. Ruma suggests finding one boy and one girl. I reply, I want 20. Ruma approaches three boys. As she talks, they stare at me before running off to find more kids. Bangladesh is the most densely populated country in the world, so it's not long before we have a crowd. We line up the kids and start passing out tickets. A group of middle-aged men in the crowd point to an old man. I push my way through the onlookers and hand him a ticket. Inside the park, there are no lines. We are the line. For our first ride, we choose one that I know from the county fairs of my childhood, called the Spider. The kids hoot and holler as it spins. There are two roller coasters in Fantasy Kingdom. I point to the big one in the distance. The kids cheer. As we march off, the barefoot kids don't complain about the scalding hot, sun-baked stone. They just skip. Children here aren't used to being kids. They have responsibilities, like jobs. Habir is a garment worker. So are Russell and Zuman. Six of the children are street scavengers. They pick through trash for plastic bottles they might be able to sell. A 9-year-old girl, the youngest of our group, isn't wearing shoes or a shirt. I buy her one for $1. Also in our number are two shopkeepers, a 14-year-old herbal doctor, four food vendors, two barbers, and the old man. Mr. Azar is a father of seven. He has a white beard and a distinguished face. I board the roller coaster and take the front car with him. He eyes the seatbelt bewildered. I buckle it for him. He follows my lead and holds up his hands as we ratchet our way up the hill. He drops them at the top, hanging on hard. His head falls to my shoulder as we round a sharp curve. While the kids squeal behind us, Mr. Azar laughs quietly. By the ride's end, we are both laughing so hard we have tears in our eyes. On our way out, I read a sign at the gate explaining the mythology of Fantasy Kingdom. Once upon a time, Prince Ashu and Princess Leah spent their days in fun and frolic with the people of their kingdom. But this mysterious kingdom disappeared when the people forgot how to smile. Prince Ashu recreated his lost kingdom here so that people would forget their worries and again learn to smile and have fun. $67 is more than a month's wage for many people in Bangladesh. Maybe I should have done something more practical for the kids with my money. But if they look up at the park's high arch gate while on their way to work or picking through trash and remember the roller coaster and how their stomach was in their throat and the wind in their hair and they escaped just for a bit, it was money well spent. Every kid has the right to a little fun. For a few hours, we were the kings of Fantasy Kingdom, and we had a blast.
Kelsey Timmerman is a freelance writer born and raised in Ohio, which he calls the roller coaster capital of the world. He says his favorite roller coaster is called The Beast. And that's where we end the show this week. Remember, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, and you can download a podcast at our website. The address again, worldvisionreport.org. The show is produced by Beverly Abel. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is the engineering assistant. Chris Baldiga is our production assistant. And I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the organization.